Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Businesses are still struggling to find strategies to get back on track as Delaware's reopening plan remains stuck in phase two.
They really don't know, and they really don't know. They don't know how to plan. You know, we can't really come up with any bold ideas until we know how this pandemic is going to play out.
Contributor John Hurdle has more on where things stand after sitting in on a virtual conference for businesses this week. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine how the uncertainty of school reopening plans are affecting back-to-school shopping. And bring you more from our collaboration with the Delaware State News, Building Bridges. Plus, our latest edition of Arts Playlist. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware has been in phase two of its reopening plan for over a month now, with no firm indication when it could move to phase three. And as a matter of fact, this week saw the first state land back on the travel advisory lists of its neighbor New Jersey, as well as New York and Connecticut, after a slight upward trend in COVID-19 cases. The uncertainty that surrounds moving ahead with reopening means many Delaware businesses are seeing their efforts to recover stall, as they also wrestle with how they'll navigate the post-COVID world. The Delaware State Chamber of Commerce hosted a virtual conference this week addressing these issues, and contributor John Hurdle sat in on it. His piece on the conference is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to tell us more about what he learned. Let's start with where Delaware is right now. It's stuck in phase two with case numbers and test percentages bobbing around the benchmarks. Organizations like the WHO consider indicators that the virus is under control. Governor John Carney did speak at this virtual conference this week. Let's start with what he had to say about where things stand and what's next to these businesses that were online trying to figure out what's next.
Well, really, the focus of his comments was we have to get healthy first. And the governor did not make any forecasts or assurances that there was any additional reopening coming anytime soon. But he emphasized that, as he has done all along, that if there's going to be a healthy economy, there has to be a healthy population as well.
And I noted in the intro, Delaware is back on the travel advisory lists for New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut after being taken off a week ago. That means if you go to one of those states from Delaware, you're being asked to quarantine for 2 weeks. This also wound up being a topic of conversation at the conference. It was actually announced during the day of the conference with House Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf echoing Governor John Carney's frustration over this whole situation. But I was really interested in some of the rationale that Schwarzkopf gave for his anger. Can you give us a little bit of the detail there? Because it really highlights a specific issue that the beaches are facing with this kind of on-again, off-again travel advisory thing.
Well, of course, the Speaker used some pretty choice language to express his frustration on this particular point. I mean, he referred to, quote, knuckleheads in New Jersey who he said had imposed reimposed the quarantine restrictions for its citizens who might be considering coming to Delaware. And he also referred to, quote, the damn list of states that were on this quarantine. But I think you're right, Tom. The real source of his frustration here was this on again, off again, because Delaware was on the list, and then it was off the list after Governor Carney successfully argued that there was no medical justification for it being on that quarantine list. And as we speak, it's on again. But the examples that he gave were, he said that he'd been getting a lot of calls from hotels and restaurants on the shore that had been hoping that they could salvage what's already been a disastrous summer season for them, and maybe even prevent their businesses closing. I mean, that was on the basis of when Delaware was actually off the list of those other states, and then of course he started receiving a storm of protests when Delaware went back on the list, and he said that you know, it looks like we're going to have another poor weekend this coming weekend as a result of that.
And given where things are right now, the conference, you know, is trying to offer some roadmaps for surviving some of the situations like the one you just talked about. It seemed like one overarching theme was simply flexibility. What was said about this kind of need to adapt and pivot quickly to try and keep your head above water?
Well, one, I thought, pretty vivid illustration of that was a speaker from a distillery, the painted stave distillery in Smyrna, and he told the story of how his business had been, this is Ron Gomez, of how his business had been built up. It started in 2011, and by earlier this year, it had about 15 employees. But of course, that all came to a sudden halt in March when the state shut down all non-essential businesses. And so at that point, the distillery very quickly pivoted to manufacturing hand sanitizer, and there was demand for that, from March to May, the company, that's what it did. But then, when the state moved into phase two, the demand for the sanitizer itself kind of dried up, and so now the company is trying to ramp up with outdoor dining. It's reopening. It's at the outdoor portion of its premises, albeit with a very much reduced capacity. So I mean, this was presented as an example of the way in which small businesses have ridden out this storm so far by being very flexible and very adaptable.
One of the other things discussed was IT and broadband needs, a common theme in almost any discussion of the pandemic and kind of coping with it. They have become major factors in business recovery, haven't they?
Well, indeed they have. I mean, just to go back to the distillery example for a second, Mr. Gomez, who spoke at the conference, was talking about lessons for the future, and one of the things he said was that in the anticipation that they are going to have in future a lot more demand for their products coming to them online. So that's what that's going to mean is that they'll probably have to modify their software to fulfill orders and to deliver orders. And of course, you know, that company is going to be looking for people who are capable of delivering those services.
Which brings us to the idea of workforce retraining. And I was struck by a fact in your piece that you mentioned there's a number that they kind of put on the number of people who are going to need workforce retraining. And can you tell us a little bit about that number? And it seemed pretty stark.
Well, indeed. One of the statistics that came out of this event was that 80% of businesses' needs for people over the next decade are expected to come from the existing workforce rather than from new employees who may have been trained in various skills in colleges. And of course, what all that means is that many people are going to have to be retrained, and especially in IT, that will allow companies to prosper and individuals to prosper in this post-COVID world.
You also got to hear a bit about trade and specifically where things stand with the Port of Wilmington and its expansion. How is the port doing through all this?
Well, according to Eric Casey, the CEO down there, it's actually a relatively upbeat picture. He did say that the container volume is steady, although the overall volume of cargo going through the port is down, and he said, you know, part of that picture is that they're handling a lot less bulk than they did, and one of the reasons for that is that there's hundreds of mines all over the world that are closed down, so all kinds of bulk materials that come out of that float around the world that come through the Port of Wilmington are not happening at the moment. He was also talking about this major port expansion into their new Edgemoor, their planned Edgemoor terminal is still going ahead, and he was upbeat that those plans remained on track.
And that's a big deal, obviously, because there's a lot of jobs that could be connected to that. You also know there's some other businesses that have found opportunity, including one many people know mainly for making spacesuits. That's ILC Dover. Tell us a little bit about their situation and their story.
Well, they were actually pretty upbeat as well. You know, they make protective equipment, protective clothing for pharmaceutical and the aerospace and other industries. And what one of their senior people told the conference was that there had actually been a 1,200% increase in demand for respirators. And one of the effects of that has been that they had a 20% increase in the number of employees that they have. So they are now employing about 600 people. So they've positively responded to these extraordinary circumstances, and that's actually worked for them.
Finally, you've been reporting on the COVID impact on the economy for us for a while now, since the pandemic started. After sitting through this conference, what's your sense of how Delaware is faring, and what's the level of optimism versus pessimism at this point?
Well, what I took away from this thing was a message of uncertainty. I mean, there's obviously been a resurgence in the infection rates even though Delaware is doing relatively well, of course the infection rates are going through the roof in some states. There's no clear signals about, as I said at the outset, about from the state government about when there might be a further reopening or what it's going to look like. And of course, all of this is must be having a huge effect on consumer confidence. I mean, people don't want to go to bars and restaurants. People don't want to go to stores. People want to ensure their personal safety if at all possible. So I think what the business community is taking away from all this is that they really don't know, and they really don't know how to plan. Finally, one indication of this uncertainty came from one of the lawmakers who spoke in the final session of this conference. And I mean, that the title of that session was Bold Ideas, and he said, well, you know, we can't really come up with any bold ideas until we know how this pandemic is going to play out, and we just need to be sure that this thing is finally under control before we can get back up to speed.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. You can read his reporting on Delaware's COVID-19 economic recovery at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Will uncertainty over how schools will reopen make a dent in back-to-school shopping numbers? We'll examine that question next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Most of the talk about the upcoming school year is understandably centered on whether school buildings and college campuses will reopen, even partially, or will kids start the new year the way they ended the last, learning remotely at home. But that uncertainty has implications beyond what teaching and learning will look like and all the issues that go with it. This time of year is normally back-to-school shopping season, but what does that look like if you don't know if your kid's going to a school building or learning from home? And is this yet another potential hit for retailers already reeling from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic? Contributor Eileen Dalabrida takes a look at these issues in her latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org, and she checked in this week to discuss what she found. So like everything else, uncertainty rules the day with back-to-school shopping as well. Your piece points out that even the most basic thing is up in the air, the old school supply list. Families normally would have them at this point, but right now, most don't, right?
They do not. The only parents I've spoken with who have lists received them at the end of last year before the COVID-19 epidemic turned the world upside down, and those lists likely won't be valid in the current climate.
And that leaves parents wondering what they should be buying, stuff they would normally need in a classroom for their kids or things that they would need to learn from home again. And there is a pretty wide gap between those two things, right?
There is. The few items that you'll find on both the remote and in-person back-to-school shopping lists are things like masks and hand sanitizer. But if kids are learning from home, they won't need a lunchbox. They can do without new clothes. And as time goes on, they might not be getting that new winter coat unless they outgrow the old one. And if they don't already have pricey items like laptops, parents can look at spending a lot more than they would have on a backpack and sneakers.
Yeah, so obviously there'd be a heavy emphasis on the tech side of things if you're learning from home, and more so on kind of the usual stuff, notebooks, pencils, crayons, if you're going back to school. It's a very different thing. But with all that in mind, projections for what back-to-school spending will look like this year are kind of a mixed bag. So what are groups like the National Retail Federation, Deloitte, and others that track this saying about what they see back-to-school shopping looking like for retailers this year?
Well, Tom, I've been covering retail for more than 20 years, and I have never seen such a wide span of forecasts. The National Retail Federation is doubling down on remote learning, betting that items like laptops, headphones, desks, and chairs will push spending to unprecedented heights. They predict a record spending of almost $34 billion zooming past the $26.2 billion last year. They expect that parents with kids in elementary school through high school will spend an average of $789 per family, and that parents of college-age students will spend an average of $1,059. And WalletHub and other forecasters say, nope, it's going to be flat, because parents are only going to buy what they absolutely need.
It will be interesting to keep an eye on that as things progress. But how are retailers handling it right now? Are they going to go all in on tech and de-emphasize the backpack and the lunchbox? Or are they trying to straddle the fence? Is there a strategy for retailers at this point?
Well, my sources tell me that retailers are playing it by ear and shifting as fast as they can to come up with new developments. Most of the promotions aren't expected to be out until August, which is the latest ever, just in trying to keep current and kind of keep their fingers on the pulse of what's going on.
And that, of course, makes sense, because we're seeing so many schools, even here in Delaware, start to push back the start date for school. So it may actually wind up pushing back to school shopping back a little bit as well. Same maybe in some cases for the college crowd. Again, here in Delaware, a mixed bag. UD just announcing this week it will conduct classes mostly online this fall. DSU, though, Delaware State, remains committed to opening its campus. Is there a conventional wisdom on shopping for college students and how it will affect retailers in this current status?
Well, retailers who were clobbered by the pandemic, like JCPenney and Staples and Bed Bath & Beyond, they had really hoped to, in some way, repair their profits in the critical back-to-school shopping season, which is second only to the winter holidays in terms of sales. So that is not a good thing for them. Typically, you would expect that kids need everything from mini-fridges to lemons to microwaves to coffee pots. And with many college kids studying remotely, that opportunity for sales is shrinking.
And you talked to some parents about this whole situation. What did they have to say? Because I imagine it is also something that kind of runs a wide spectrum of approaches.
They do. Parents have a lot on their minds. The pandemic, of course, the economy, especially moms and dads who have been furloughed or aren't working, and now whether or not there will be school. And if classes do meet in person, they're concerned, will their kids be safe?
And I guess, you know, for them, it's a tough situation, because if you're looking at going back to school, you mentioned that there's the health and safety factor. Do parents need to think about buying multiple masks so that they have masks to rotate each day, hand sanitizer, wipes and such? I mean, I know many teachers usually ask for things like wipes and sanitizer along with tissues and paper towels in a normal year, but they're for community use in the classroom. Is there a sense that parents may need to think about making sure their kids have their own stuff if they go to school or have to get on the bus to make sure that they're able to keep themselves safe?
Yes, it's more important than ever that kids be equipped with what they need to be safe and know how to use it. You can't rely on the school. You need to be prepared, and you need to be self-reliant.
And I guess, you know, you kind of alluded to this earlier. This is all coming against the backdrop of the pandemic-created recession, high unemployment, the uncertainty of what government assistance may or may not be available for families, for schools, and for the economy in general. Having talked to retailers, experts, families, can you quantify the level of angst that's being created by something that's usually so basic, just getting your back-to-school shopping done?
Well, it's adding more agita to a time that's already fraught with uncertainty. There are a lot of moms and dads who really feel overburdened, especially if they're single parents or both parents are working and they have a couple of kids in different grades and they're trying to do their jobs. They have their kids at home. They're, kind of homeschooling them. They had been homeschooling them. And so they're overwhelmed at the prospect of having to keep that up. And also the whole thing of back-to-school shopping, it used to be such a joy. You know, I would talk to moms and dads and kids, and it's something that they really, really enjoyed, that the family would go to the store together and then maybe get some ice cream. And it was just a pleasure. They could have sat down with a laptop and ordered things online, but they didn't want to because it was a good family time, a good thing to do together. And it's not a fun time this year.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time this week. You can read her reporting on back-to-school shopping at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with more of our Building Bridges collaboration with the Delaware State News. Conversations with Delawareans working in the community on social justice and furthering racial equality. Stay with us for that. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We take some time again this week to focus on our latest collaboration with the Delaware State News, Building Bridges, conversations with Delawareans working in the community on social justice and furthering racial equality. The past 2 weeks, we brought you interviews done by our own Sophia Schmidt for this project, but there are many more available from Delaware State News reporters at DelawareStateNews.net. And this week, we're joined by one of those reporters, Katie Redifer, who has produced pieces on Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice Chairwoman Charlotte King and Delaware Division of Human Relations Director Ramona Fulman. Let's start with Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice Chairwoman Charlotte King. She is 82, and your piece notes that aside from attending marches in her youth, King has said she was never a member of any racial activism groups before the Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice. So in talking to her, you know, what brought her to the issue of racial justice later in life when she started this group not that long ago, back in 2015?
Right. Well, what we talked about, you know, is Ms. King, she's a black woman, of course, and so she's experienced racism her entire life. Being an 82-year-old woman, that's a long time. And we talked a lot about different microaggressions, and she kind of said for her that eventually she got to a point in her life where she said, like, enough is enough. And she felt more inclined to speak out and to organize. And so she was actually president of the League of Women Voters before this group was formed in 2015. And so she was working with them already. And so she kind of was in that sphere of working with different people in the community and talking about different social issues. And so she heard about this new book, and it was called The New Jim Crow. It's about mass incarceration. I think I mentioned it in the story. And she had heard about it from her friend out of state, and she thought people would be really interested in it. So she gauged interest for a book club discussing it, and she was correct. There were a lot of people that were interested, and they met for 8 weeks to discuss the book, and it was really popular. And she said people had a really good time. They had very strong emotional reactions to the book because, you know, it's a very serious topic, mass incarceration of black Americans. It hits home for a lot of people. And so she formed this Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice out of that book club. And they do still actually have a separate book club, which they discuss similar books. So yeah, that was really where it came from, was the interest in that was just so high that she was like, well, why not start a group where we specifically address racism in the area and how it affects our lives here?
And in your piece, you note that, you know, this group isn't the type that necessarily is focusing on marches and protests. So in talking to her, like, what is the approach of the Southern Delaware Alliance for racial justice? And what is that, I guess, you know, kind of how does Ms. King kind of use it to affect change in maybe in a way that, you know, isn't what people might normally see or normally think of in terms of protests and marches and things like that?
Right. Ms. King, her approach to racial equity is definitely through education and starting conversations. And, you know, marches and protests are certainly important to her, and she's participated in those before. But her approach really is to kind of unify the community and start those conversations. Like, we talked a lot about American history and how that ties to racism and the different forms of discrimination that have existed over the decades. And she really just wants to kind of end those stereotypes. And so the ways that they do that is they meet monthly at the Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice, and they invite guest speakers like writers, activists, politicians, former police chiefs, former inmates, students, all types of different people with different perspectives on issues of race so that they can start timely conversations about how it affects our community and, you know, find a common ground of interest and ways that we can all agree, like, hey, this is a problem, so we should address it this way. And I think it's pretty effective, and I think it's interesting. Like, they had a Juneteenth panel, I know, and they had one on the 14th of this month, and they always invite interesting guests and such, like I said. And they also, they do other efforts too in the community. Like, she established the Black Film Festival. It's at the Art Cinema Theater every year. She's hosted several expungement clinics over the year for nonviolent youth offenders, and it helps educate them about how they can get their criminal records cleared. And she actually does help. She helped a lot of them over the years get those criminal records expunged. So that's pretty cool. And she also offers a lot of scholarships to high school students. The Alliance, they do 10 plus scholarships every year to high school students, and they ask them to write about racial justice. And so through all these different types of methods, and there's lots of other stuff we talked about too, that's really her goal, is to kind of change those preconceived ideas people have about race and try to start those conversations up.
I was going to say, that really interested me too, that she had this kind of real interest in history and changing these misconceptions and misperceptions. Are there some specific misconceptions and misperceptions that she's trying to get at?
Right. So specifically, she's talking about race when she says that, and the way that Black Americans are viewed, especially over history. You know, one of the things I quoted her on was the Three-Fifths Compromise, which is part of the U.S. Constitution back when the United States was first made. And it just showed how, even from the beginning, it was like Black Americans were devalued to less than human. And so she thinks that racism is a taught behavior, you know. People are socialized into thinking that way about Black people. It's part of our laws, part of our Constitution, like I said. And so she thinks that by, like I said, through those education, that's how we can overcome it and acknowledge, like, hey, this is racist behavior. This is how racism exists in our world. And, like, how can we change that and stop having these misperceptions about Black people, you know, being inferior, or being criminals, and why they're wrong and where those views come from. And so, you know, she's, like we said, she's 82. So she has so much perspective on how that's, like, going on. And so it's really interesting talking to her about it.
And I was curious about that perspective that she has, because, as you said, she's 82. She has a very long view of all of this and the arc of this battle for racial equity. I'm curious, in your conversation, what did she have to say about what's going on right now and how it kind of fits into what she's seen over time and what she's hoping to do through the Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice to kind of be part of this moment.
Yeah, so she said she's been happy to see these new discussions of race and things like police brutality come up, because, you know, this is what she's been trying to do for years now. She's been trying to start these conversations. And so she said to me she was excited to see more people involved in this. And she actually, the Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice, initiated one of, if not the biggest protest in Rehoboth Beach earlier this summer, back in June. It was by the Tanger Outlets, and I was there reporting on that too, so I was there for it. And it was like hundreds of people there, and it was organized by Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice, and they did have to pull out of their sponsorship the day of, because they were getting pressure from police, essentially worried about looters coming, which did not happen. But they still attended the event just to show support, and she said she was so happy to see, like, the diversity of age and race too, and how it was just all these people from the community coming together and really saying, you know, enough is enough, that racism is an issue and that we need to address it and be open about it, because otherwise it's not going to be solved. And so she very much is involved in things like that going on at the moment and does care a lot. And she also, one of the things we talked about, the only like concern she really brought up about different race discussions that are happening now is reactionary legislation, which is something I mentioned in the story too. And we talked about specifically new legislation passed by the General Assembly to ban chokehold use by police. And she talked about different caveats that a lot of laws like that have and different loopholes. And, you know, it is true in that legislation, they have a part in it that says, and I had to read this myself for different reporting I did on it, you know, police can use chokeholds if they feel their life or another person's life is threatened. And so when she said to me is when you take, when you put loopholes in legislation like that, it takes away the power. And so she doesn't want to see legislation like that be passed. She wants to see stronger legislation in the future. But, you know, otherwise she's happy to see that we're making some type of progress. You know, showing up even imperfectly is better than not showing up. So
the other woman you profiled was Delaware Division of Human Relations Director Ramona Fulman. And I thought it was interesting that she tapped into something that we've heard from a number of people during these protests, a kind of weariness of having to fight these battles. What did she have to say about that and how it relates to her work?
Right. So her approach to handling racism is a little bit different than Ms. King. So she works more on the systemic side, and she handles different complaints from people who've experienced housing discrimination and things like that, and how to enforce laws of discrimination. And so what we talked about is people like that who've had issues with housing discrimination, public access and such, a lot of times they are weary because that's a generational type of racism and it carries over. You know, Black Americans are not just carrying the burden of the oppression they've experienced, but the burden of their parents and their grandparents and all their ancestors before them. And racism has existed for so long in America that they feel tired from that. And it infiltrates all aspects of their lives. You know, they can't find housing. They have trouble finding jobs. It's harder to get into universities. And so when she works with these people, a lot of times they are tired. But, you know, that's why her job is so important, because she's the one who's got to be there to know when discrimination is happening and when it's considered illegal and how to enforce those laws.
And she also noted in her conversation with you that these issues are kind of part of her personal journey to make a difference. So can you talk to us a little bit about how, you know, she was kind of able to relate the systemic work that she's doing to her own kind of personal journey?
Mm-hmm. So we talked more about her job and less about her personal background than I did with Ms. King. But, you know, one of the things we did say is that she said this to me, it's interesting how you can find like the wealthiest, most privileged, educated Black man, and he'll still have a story about how he's been discriminated against. And so I think this definitely applies to her. You know, Ms. Fulman, she's a lawyer, actually. She went to law school. And so she's experienced all this discrimination in her life, too, just like all the other Black Americans. You know, her parents would tell her these stories of discrimination they've experienced because they were educators and, you know, working in schools and what that's like. So it definitely is something that affects her personally, and that's part of the reason why she cares.
She also sees a connection between some of these racial inequity issues and gender discrimination. Did that come out in your conversation as well?
Yeah, so Ms. Fulman, she also worked with the League of Women Voters, both her and Ms. King. It's a pretty popular group, obviously, in the state. But she was part of that board for years before getting into the State Division of Human Relations, and so she has worked closely with gender discrimination. And another one of the big things that me and Ms. Fulman talked about were the intersectionality of discrimination. You can't ever just look at one aspect of discrimination because they're all related. You know, being a Black American is hard, but it becomes much harder when you're a Black woman, and also becomes continuously harder if you're an LGBT Black woman. And so you can't have one of those disparities without the other, right? And so, like, that's what she talked about, too, is she doesn't get the option of picking an issue that's most important to her in her job, because, you know, if someone can't get housing, then they're probably also having trouble getting a job. And if they can't get a job, it might be because they don't have a good educational background. And that's also hard to get involved in with racial discrimination. And, you know, none of those things can be changed. People aren't voting. And so she really views these all as tied together. And one of the things we talked about specific to gender was pay inequity. And I did quote her on this in my story, but, you know, how white women are paid less than white men, but also Black women are paid much more and Hispanic women are paid less more. And so it's yeah, they're all connected.
And so where did she kind of see things going in this moment when you talked to her a little bit about kind of the intersection of her life and experiences and her job and what's going on right now?
Right. So the ways that Ms. King and Ms. Fullman agree is they're very much both based on education, and they think that's the best way to fight against discrimination. And so, you know, her job, she works with what's legal and what's not as far as discrimination. And so she's going to keep working on that as far as handling complaints that she gets and mediating different situations of tension that people come to her with. And she said she also wants to focus more on fair economic opportunities because, again, that can affect so many parts of people's lives if they don't have enough money to support them. And she also, again, is interested in changing the education system in the ways that people are taught about, you know, racial discrimination in schools, too. And I had a quote here written down. She said, "It requires an investment of your spirit, mind, and resources to end discrimination." And so I think that's really what she wants to do, is to keep dedicating her life to this and her work to this.
Thanks to Delaware State News reporter Katie Redifer for her time this week. You can find her Building Bridges pieces and others at DelawareStateNews.net. And we wrap up The Green Next with Arts Playlist and a look at two exhibits now showing at the reopened Brandywine River Museum of Art. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Brandywine River Museum of Art is welcoming visitors again and offering two exhibits put on hold during its COVID-19 shutdown. Amanda Burden is curator for Votes for Women, A Visual History, and an accompanying exhibition, Witness to History, The Selma Photography of Stephen Summerstein. Votes for Women features imagery of the suffrage movement and looks at the tools used to spread its message. Witness to History picks up the struggle for voting rights with 55 photographs taken during the historic 1965 Civil Rights March from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Burden about both of these exhibitions.
Let's talk about these two exhibitions. Let's start with Votes for Women, A Visual History. What's it all about?
Well, if you didn't know, you will soon, that this year, 2020, is the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. And that's the amendment that gives women the right to vote. And we have controversy over saying gives women, because they sure did fight hard for it. So in recognition of that centennial that's going on this year, we wanted to do an exhibition that marked the historic nature of that anniversary, but also incorporated artwork and the visual culture of the period as well.
How important, I've asked other people this in other interviews, because I think it's relatable. How important is Votes for Women, A Visual History, this exhibition, in the hashtag MeToo movement?
Oh my gosh, it is. There are so many relatable moments. I've gone through on a few tours already with groups, and they'll point out phrases, slogans, passages in text, and they say, that is just like today. And so we start out the exhibition with visuals and artifacts from a very famous march that happened in Washington, D.C. on inauguration weekend, but in 1913. And people instantly realized that women's marches on Washington in inauguration time periods have been going on for quite a while. And these suffragists were the one that began it. The rest of the exhibition absolutely deals with the beginnings of demanding rights for women. And those are voting rights at the time we're looking at, but they can easily be transformed into all kinds of citizenship rights and human rights. So I think even though we're looking at 100-year-old objects, the connection is amazing to see just how relevant all of this is for today's audience.
All right. So with this exhibition, which we want to tell people is on view until September 27th, it's called Votes for Women, A Visual History. I'm told that the Brandywine also commissioned a diverse group of women artists to create a mural of illustrated portraits featuring some of the women whose role in winning voting rights has been historically minimized. Talk to me about this.
Yes, absolutely. So it didn't take long into doing the research for this exhibition to realize that the kinds of materials that have been preserved, that have been put into museums, libraries, and historical societies don't reflect the vast stretch of womanhood that was involved with this movement. There were certain organizations that had really good publicity machines, really good archiving machines in place. And we often hear the stories of Susan B. Anthony, of the National Woman's Party, and certain other high-profile women. But in doing this exhibition, I came to understand that it's not that women of color didn't participate in the suffrage movement. It's that they were just a lot harder to see in the movement. And so as a companion to Votes for Women, A Visual History, we have commissioned five women illustrators to enlighten us on the other women whose stories have not been told. And we're calling this section of the exhibition Hidden Figures of the Suffrage Movement. And I think a lot of people will immediately relate that to the recent story of hidden figures of African-American women working with NASA. And so we have done research and sorted out 14 different women that we think are very deserving of attention and of space in the history, who either you haven't heard of or you've heard of but didn't know they were involved in the suffrage movement. For example, Sojourner Truth is often understood for her role in abolition, her very famous biography, perhaps even some folks might know her famous speech in which she says, "Ain't I a woman?" Well, you only have to take that one step further to realize she was advocating for women's rights at that time period. And so by putting these women together and having illustrators, and that's a bread and butter here at the Brandywine River Museum of Art, we really have a strong foothold in the history of illustration. And so bringing contemporary illustrators to this project was a great tie to our mission and our core history.
Now, you mentioned ties here. I understand that there's many local Delaware ties in the exhibition.
There are, as a matter of fact, right from the outset, I have a wonderful photo mural of a group of women who were preparing to go down to Washington, D.C. for a suffrage demonstration, and they are photographed at the Wilmington train station, and it's very recognizably the Wilmington train station that I have been in many times myself. And so we do follow the story of Delaware, which is interesting in the story of suffrage, because Delaware was set to be the 36th state to ratify the 19th Amendment, and 36 is the magic number of the number of states required to make that amendment law. And in June of 1920, a campaign really reached a fever pitch in Delaware. But unfortunately, the amendment did not pass in Delaware. And so we have some political cartoons that point to the failure of Delaware to bring women's suffrage to the Constitution. But then in the Hidden Figures mural that we were just talking about a minute ago, we have a number of women who are connected to Delaware in some way. So, for example, Ethel Cuff Black is a native of Wilmington, and she was one of the founders of the Delta Sigma Theta sorority. And Delta Sigma Theta was the only African-American organization to march in that very famous 1913 Washington suffrage parade on Inauguration Weekend. So we have local stories, national stories, and at times international stories.
I cannot wait to see this exhibit. Just to remind everybody, we're talking to Amanda Burden. She is the exhibition curator at the Brandywine River Museum of Art. We're talking about a new exhibition that's on view until September 27th. It's called Votes for Women, A Visual History. Now, as an accompanying photography exhibition, Amanda, Witness to History, talk to me about this.
Well, just in the same way that we took a step back and said, what's missing from our Votes for Women exhibition, and that was necessarily the faces of women of color, we realized that I personally didn't want anyone to leave the exhibition thinking that the 19th Amendment had solved voting rights issues in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking for a way to continue the narrative. And there is a photographer named Stephen Summerstein whose works we are featuring in the Witness to History exhibition. And his photographs follow the very last day of the Civil Rights March from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. And that was one of the primary forces behind the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Now, I know this is a lot of history for an art museum, but it helps give us a framework for the visions that we're going to see in the galleries. And I think you're going to see kind of paired visions between the struggle for suffrage rights by women and the struggle later in the century for suffrage rights for African Americans. You know, this all goes back to the 15th Amendment, which promised African American men voting rights. And that was imperfect as well. So the 15th Amendment and the 19th Amendment were corralled and corrected in some ways by the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And Stephen Summerstein's photographs capture this powerful final day of the march that ends in a speech by Dr. Martin Luther King, commonly known as the How Long, Not Long speech.
What is the takeaway from these exhibits, Amanda?
Well, I think, especially here in an art museum, I want people to look at these exhibitions and see history changing and see how the visual world helped to bring about those changes. And by that I mean the posters that the suffragists made, the marches that the civil rights organizers established, the banners that both would have carried, what it looks like to see social change take place right in front of you, to be that witness to history. And I think once we see that in the past, we're really set to recognize it in the current, in the present day, and see how, as Dr. King says in his speech, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And I think we're still seeing, as you mentioned earlier, how that arc is bending towards justice. And it awakens us, I think, to what's going on around us, especially in the visual world.
We've said a lot. We want people to see the exhibits. Is there anything that I'm not asking that you want people to know about either Votes for Women, a visual history exhibition, or Witness to History, the Selma Photography of Stephen Summerstein exhibit?
Yes, you know, I think something that's a little buried in the written history, but you see it when you look at the visuals, is how young the participants in both of these movements were. The leaders of this younger generation of women suffragists who really ignited the new marketing strategies that were displaying in our Votes for Women exhibition were 23, 24 years old. And of course, the organizers of the Selma marches were students themselves. And Stephen Summerstein was a college student when he photographed these. So I think in a way, this is a youth movement going on in both of these exhibitions. And I hope that's really inspiring to younger people today to realize that these massive changes to important aspects of American political culture and life were instigated by people in their 20s.
Thanks to the Brandywine River Museum of Art's Amanda Burden and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. The Votes for Women, a visual history exhibition, runs through September 27th, and Witness to History, the Selma Photography of Stephen Summerstein, runs through November 1st. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement, As the leader of the nonprofit sector, Dana is committed to strengthening, enhancing, and advancing Delaware nonprofits through low-cost training, consulting, research, and advocacy support for nonprofit leaders and board directors. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and John Hurdle, Katie Redifer from the Delaware State News, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And The Green takes a summer vacation next week, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.